The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and thank you for making the time to join me tonight. We have two CEOs of nonprofit organizations that you will hear from this evening. One, who has led his organization for over a quarter of a century, and the other, who has recently assumed her new role. First up will be Gary White, the longtime leader of Water.org, which he leads in partnership with the actor Matt Damon. And the financial model he's created that has allowed millions of the poor to have access to clean drinking water was a result of this insight.
I've been doing this a long time, ever since I was an undergraduate, you know, in college, and always trying to find new insights into how we can do this better and serve more people. And what I discovered was that people were paying, you know, 7 to 10 times more for water from these vendors than if they had a connection to the public utility.
And then you will hear from Lynn O'Connor Voss, who recently became the president and CEO of the Muscular Dystrophy Association. And she'll share with us some of her vision for where she wants to take the organization.
And so having joined recently, that's really our key strategy, is to say, okay, what is, again, the mission? How do we communicate that in a very specific way on a regular basis to everyone out there? And how do we galvanize individuals to believe that we're working as one organization?
And for our Better Than Most corporate culture segment, we'll be going down to our nation's capital and the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. But we'll begin, as always, with the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, February 25th. Nonprofit boards with higher levels of gender, age, and ethnic and racial diversity tend to have more engaged board members, this according to a report from the Indiana University Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. Making a clean break from a long-serving founder isn't necessarily the best way to ensure a successful transition to new leadership, a study by the Bridgespan Group finds. It found that, contrary to conventional wisdom, transitions that extend the role of a founder tend to yield the best results. And finally, this month's cover story from the Chronicle of Philanthropy is the Philanthropy 50, the 50 biggest donors of 2017. And covering that for the Chronicle is Maria Demento, who happens to be with us now. So Maria, what did giving look like from America's super rich in 2017?
Thank you, Denver. Giving looks good. There was an awful lot of it in 2017, and the numbers were very high. American donors on our list gave a total of more than $14.7 billion to nonprofits last year. That was really a high mark for the past decade and fell just shy of the $15.5 billion they donated in 2008. So we really saw a huge uptick in giving.
You know, we're always looking to see whether this increase is driven mostly by Wall Street or Silicon Valley. What would be the story for 2017?
Well, Wall Street and finance people are still very prominent. They're still giving very big. But the technology sector really took the lead this year, I would say. The people who ranked number one, number two, and number three were all technology people. Bill and Melinda Gates were number one. Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan were number two. And Michael and Susan Dell were number three. All of them, all of those couples, gave at least $1 billion to, in fact, mostly to their foundations. So that's a lot of money for just three couples to be giving.
Are some people getting concerned about the dominance of all these tech philanthropists?
I think there is some concern in the nonprofit sector about that, yet it is also paired with a tremendous amount of hopefulness and gratefulness, because not charities need so much money these days, and there's so much need out there that I think to see that this group of donor is really stepping up, I think provides quite a bit of hope. But of course, as with any wealthy donors, there is always going to be a concern that, you know, they will try to maybe push things in certain directions that the charities don't always want to go.
Yeah, certainly. Finally, Maria, were there any big gifts that you found to be, you know, particularly noteworthy or interesting this past year?
There were. There were some really interesting ones. We had a very large gift valued at about $165 million. It was an environmental gift from a couple who actually are also tech entrepreneurs, Jack and Laura Dangermond. They gave land a very important piece of 8 mile coastal land in Santa Barbara County, California, valued at $165 million to the Nature Conservancy. And that gift was unusual. We're not seeing a lot of really huge donations, you know, to conservation groups. So that was important. There was also some significant donations by a grocery store mogul, a man named Charles Butt in Texas, who had given quite a bit of money to start a couple of education nonprofits to train school administrators and teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Those were two that really stood out this time around.
Well, thanks very much for this report, Maria, and for being on the show.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me. It was great.
I'll be back to speak with Gary White of Water.org right after this.
The Business of Giving is pleased to feature news correspondents every week from the Chronicle of Philanthropy, a trusted source of daily news on the nonprofit world. A subscription to the Chronicle gets you instant access to practical online tools like checklists, resource guides, and expert advice, and in-depth insight into the big ideas and trends that are transforming the nonprofit world. Learn more at philanthropy.com. That's the Chronicle of Philanthropy at philanthropy.com. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Some of you, in fact, I hope most of you, may remember a spot during the Super Bowl featuring Matt Damon. The message was that if you purchased a Stella Artois beer or a limited edition chalice, you could help provide clean drinking water to a person in the developing world. The organization behind that effort is Water.org. And Matt Damon's partner in this social enterprise is Gary White, its CEO and co-founder, who is with us now. Good evening, Gary, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you, Denver.
Before we get into the specifics of the work that your organization does, provide our listeners with the dimensions of the problem. How many people in the world do not have access to clean drinking water or sanitation facilities?
It is. It's a huge problem. It's about 884 million of us don't have access to water. About 2.3 billion of us don't have access to sanitation. And we can get that at a visceral level, but what it means is things like, you know, this year, 443 million school days will be lost because kids are walking to get water. Every day, women spend about 250 million hours walking to collect water because they don't have it nearby. They have to go to a stream or a river. And that's time they could spend, you know, earning income for their family or growing food. And every 90 seconds, we lose a child because of water-related disease. So it's those big numbers boil down into real human suffering and really holding people back from developing their full potential.
Have anybody ever been able to put a number to the coping costs of what it means not to have clean water or sanitation facilities?
Sure. Those costs come in the form of that time spent collecting water, come in the form of people who live in urban slums paying water vendors that sell water from water trucks, often of dubious quality. The time that people spend going and trying to find a place to defecate because sanitation is a big part of this. So all that rolls up into about $300 billion every year that people pay in these coping costs because they don't have access to water at a faucet at their home or a toilet in their home.
Gary, how severe is the water shortage in the world right now? And for instance, Cape Town, South Africa is running out of water. I think they refer to it as day zero, and that day is going to be sometime in April. So whether it's climate change or whatever, is there enough clean drinking water for all 7 billion plus people inhabiting the earth?
Yeah, there's plenty of water on the planet to satisfy the needs of everyone and far more. The question is, you know, where is that water relative to where people live? live, and how clean is that water, and what does it cost to treat the water, to clean it up so that it is of drinking water quality. And I think that, when we look at this problem, today everyone woke up and got water somewhere, right? And they went someplace to defecate. The question becomes, how much time did they have to spend walking to collect that water? Or if they paying these water vendors, how much of their cash, and sometimes it's up to 25% of their income to purchase water from vendors, and then what's the quality of that water? And so those are the things that come together. So there's water everywhere, but the question is, how much do people have to pay in terms of the time and their health to get access to it?
Yeah, and you mentioned a moment ago about walking to get water. This truly is a women's problem, correct? I mean, they basically, literally and figuratively, carry the burden on this.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's women and usually girls that are walking to collect water because if you don't get water today, nothing else matters. So everything gets subjugated to getting water for the family. And so that's the question. Sometimes you have to spend, an hour walking to a stream to get it. Sometimes during the dry season when that's dried up, maybe you have to walk 2 or 3 hours. And that's part of the whole problem, too. People don't have consistency with respect to where they're getting their water every day. And if you don't have that, you can't go out and work at a paying job, for instance, because you can't show up on time. And so this whole crisis and what it means for families, it underpins everything in terms of building a better life for your family, building the health of your family, and building the economy of your community.
Yeah. And I don't think people realize what you just mentioned a moment ago is that people actually pay for water and they pay some pretty significant rates to get that. Tell us about that and how that provided you with your aha moment in creating the model for water.org.
Yeah, I think that I've been doing this a long time, ever since I was an undergraduate, in college. And always trying to find new insights into how we can do this better and serve more people. And what I discovered was that people were paying, 7 to 10 times more for water from these vendors than if they had a connection to the public utility, right? So the subsidies that go into the system usually subsidize the people who already have faucets in their homes and, the middle class and so on. And so what we saw was that people who were living in the greatest poverty were actually having to go to water vendors in order to get their water.
It's very expensive to be poor, isn't it?
It's extremely expensive to be poor. That's a great way of putting it. And so what we saw was like, how about if we could get people access to a loan, a small loan, so that they could pay the connection fee? Because what's holding them back, the barrier between them and safe water, is this fee that they need to pay to connect to the public utility. That can be $200 to $300. So they might have a dollar every day or $2 every day to pay a water vendor, but they don't have $300 all up front. And so what we said is like, why can't we get them access to microloans so that they can get over that hump and get the connection, and then their expenditures go way down.
So it's access to affordable capital. That's at the heart of it. Yeah. So how do you do this? I mean, do you do it yourselves through water.org, or have you created a network of microcredit institutions that you partner with?
Yeah. So we didn't want to reinvent the wheel and become a bank at water.org. And so what we knew was that there was this extensive microfinance network out there in the world. And so we piggybacked onto microfinance to kind of get them nudged towards making loans for water and sanitation. And I think what you see, it took quite a nudge to make that happen because they're used to making loans for sewing machines or cows and things like that, and where you can see that people could start having a cash flow to repay their loan after a week, right? And people in the microfinance industry didn't understand these coping costs and how much the poor were paying for water. And so what we can do is help them buy back their time with this approach. They can use that time to earn an income, and they can use the income to repay the microfinance loan. And so we've done this now. We've made over 2 million loans through our partner network. And depending on the country, those are repaid at between 97 and 99%. And over 80% of the borrowers are women.
Fantastic.
So this is having quite an impact so far.
Where do you get this capital to begin with?
So we at water.org raise philanthropic capital to be able to help cover the startup costs for these microfinance institutions. We help them do the market research. We help them hire the right staff so that they can still start making these loans. So we use that philanthropic capital to basically get this ready for investment capital to fund the actual loans that go out to poor households. And we created a spinoff called Water Equity that now raises social impact capital. It provides a financial return to investors, but it also provides this huge social return. So, for instance, an investor that invests $1 million in our fund that lasts for 7 years, that $1 million will help someone, it will help 100,000 people get access to water over the course of that time. And each year along the way, the investor will get a distribution. We target about 2-3%. And at the end of the 7 years, they get their $1 million back. Mm. So it's a way of bringing more capital into the system, because the thing about this, Denver, is that the problem actually contains its own solution.
Yeah, it does.
When you look at that $300 billion in coping cost, mm-hmm. that's money that's already there. And if we can use our access to capital for the poor to redirect some of those expenditures, then they're going to get water, they're going to have a lower water tariff, and they're going to pay off their loan after 2 years, and they're going to be free and clear.
Mm-hmm. And your first fund raised $11 million, mm-hmm. $11 million, and now on your way to a $50 million second fund, of which you're about three quarters of the way there. Mm-hmm. What kind of rate of return are your investors getting? You said they're getting their capital back. Do they get mm-hmm. a little bit more than that?
Yeah. So on the first fund that we did, we paid our first distribution last year, and we paid 3.6%.
Very nice.
On that. So that's an annual distribution, and we anticipate the same on this next fund.
How many people have you been able to help through this process?
So we have just recently crossed over 10 million people that we've helped get access to water or sanitation, and the momentum is building. Before we had the water credit approach with microfinance, we were a more traditional water NGO helping get wells drilled and systems built. And, you know, from 1990 up until 2012, it took us that long to reach our first 1 million people.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're reaching more than 4 million people every year because of the multiplier effect of adding credit to the mix.
How much money do you think it's going to take to address this problem?
Well, it's going to take, if we want to meet the Sustainable Development Goal number 6, which is safe water and sanitation for everybody, we're going to have to invest about $1 trillion.
Okay.
And I think that's part of this, why we drove in the direction of helping people with finance, because if you add up, you know, all of the funds that go into water philanthropy and water aid, it's about $8 billion a year. And if you need $1 trillion, it's going to take a long time to get there.
A long time.
So, mm-hmm.
What do you see as the role of government in these emerging nations? And have you partnered with any mm-hmm. of them in any particular fashion?
So we have partnered with governments, and we do it at different levels. One is that, you know, water supply, particularly in urban areas, is really a natural monopoly where it's really more efficient to have one utility providing water rather than a lot of, you know, fragmented water solutions. And so we work with them to hopefully extend the network of pipes into to the poorer neighborhoods. And so they are responsible for that, but they also need paying customers to make mm-hmm. the utility work. And so what we do then is help deliver those customers and collaborate with government to make the utilities more efficient and more effective, because they can now start collecting these water tariffs and these connection fees. I was just in the Philippines recently, and, you know, where we're working with the utilities and microfinance there. And I think there's a really great example of how we need to do more of this, because I met a woman there who, before she had her water credit loan, she was paying about $60 a month to these water vendors.
Mm-hmm.
And she took out a loan, and now her water tariff is about $4.50 a month, and her loan payment is about $5 a month. So right there, she went from paying $50 or $60 a month down to 10. After she pays her loan off, she'll be paying $5 a month. So you can see right there why people want these loans so much. But right next to her in this conversation was her neighbor, who wanted to do this desperately, but the utility hadn't extended the pipes yet to mm-hmm. her home. And so that's why we need to work with the utilities to help them understand if they invest in that infrastructure, these paying customers will show up.
There are indeed some very good customers at the base mm-hmm. of the pyramid, aren't there?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Let me turn to your organization for a minute. How did you and Matt Damon first connect to join forces to start water.org back in 2009?
Mm-hmm. Well, Matt had started with some other folks an organization called H2O Africa, and was really moved by the need that he saw in terms of water supply and other issues of poverty. And so that organization was going along great. And of course, you know, I'd co-founded Water Partners back mm-hmm. in 1990. And we got introduced. And, you know, Matt and his team were in the early stages. So they were doing really well at raising funds and raising awareness. And they, obviously, they had a great platform. And what we were kind of like the heads down kind of wonky engineers that knew how to get stuff done on the ground. And so as we got to know each other, you know, H2O Africa was basically investing their funds through us to go get the work done. And so Matt and I got comfortable with each other. It's like, you know, there is a real symmetry here. Maybe we should just bring the organizations together. And so, you know, we worked on that. And then we merged in 2009 and rebranded as water.org, which was the URL we already had.
Mm-hmm.
And we've never looked back.
Worked out quite nicely. You really complement each other. Mm-hmm. Gary, water.org is very much of a bottoms-up organization. When you go into a country, you're more likely to address the poor, be with them, see what their problems are in accessing water, as opposed to, let's say, setting up a meeting with the Minister of Health. Mm-hmm. How do you think that approach has impacted how you go about your work?
Yeah, that's a really great insight, Denver. It really is a bottom-up approach. I mean, what we've done is say, you know, and I consider us as much an innovation organization as a water organization.
Mm-hmm.
And when we say, what are the barriers that are standing between people and safe water? And, you know, initially we thought that was pumps and wells, and that is part of it. But what we saw was that really hundreds of millions of people could get access to safe water if they just got access to affordable capital. So the bottom-up approach is like people know, like the woman in the Philippines, she knows that if the pipes came closer to her home, she would be able to pay the fee, she would have water, boom, done. And so what we saw was that so many people knew exactly how they wanted to improve their water and sanitation. They just lacked the capital to do so. And that's the bottom-up approach. Like that's the barrier that we saw. So let's take away that barrier of affordable finance so that they can get the solutions that they need. And so that has allowed us to really accelerate and reach more people because we take people's, you know, donations now and multiply them. So we've put about $21 million into getting water credit jump started in different countries around the world. That's now raised over $700 million in investment capital that actually makes those loans to the poor households. So that bottom-up approach has potential to really scale.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're really not just going to the bottoms up. You're just going to where the answers are, and those answers are in those communities. These people know exactly what they need.
That's exactly
to
right.
make this work. Mm-hmm. Speaking of innovation, you have something called the New Ventures Fund, which mm-hmm. is made up of philanthropic capital, sort of your R&D arm, if you will.
Yes.
Anything there with any real promise that you're excited about?
Yeah, a couple of things. You know, we've used that New Ventures Fund as research and development for us to expand water credit into new geographies, new parts of the world mm-hmm. where we have to adjust the model and do things
differently. How many nations are you in now?
We're in about 17 countries now. And so we can expand geographically with that. We can use that New Ventures Fund to like get into more digital finance, right? So there's a lot that's happening in developing countries with respect to reducing the transaction cost of these loans. Instead of having a loan collector go around on a bicycle every week and collect, you know, cash from these borrowers, looking into kind of digital finance where they can have electronic accounts and make that happen. And, you know, we wouldn't have water equity as a new organization and a spinoff if we hadn't had the New Ventures Fund.
Right.
Because water equity was incubated inside of water.org and until it was ready to spin off as a separate fund investment manager.
You really believe in market-based solutions, but from a philanthropic perspective, has it been a challenge to get people interested in financial supporting a cause that in most cases they've never really actually witnessed?
Yeah, it has been a challenge, but I really believe that tide is turning. I think that most people in the United States have never really been thirsty. I mean, we've been thirsty if we're out for a run or something like that, but we've never experienced, like, you know, gut-wrenching thirst. Or, you know, if we have a child that has diarrhea, you know, it's just kind of a thing that happens. It passes in a couple of days and goes on. And so, you know, it's so different for people if that all of a sudden becomes life-threatening. So it's people are starting to wake up to this, I think, are responding more to water and sanitation needs from the top down, but also from the bottom up.
Mm-hmm.
And the grassroots donors are beginning to respond.
You know, I mentioned in the opening the cause-related marketing program you have with Stella Artois. Provide us with some more details of how that promotion works and maybe also of some of your other corporate partnerships.
Yeah, so we've been really fortunate with the Stella Artois relationship. We've been really fortunate with IKEA Foundation, MasterCard Foundation, Caterpillar Foundation. We've really struck a chord with a lot of different
corporate foundations.
Absolutely, and they've been fantastic. And you know, our model resonates with them, you know, the bottom-up and the market-based solution. And with Stella in particular, you mentioned the Super Bowl commercial. That was an opportunity not to really promote Stella Artois or water.org itself, but it was to draw attention to this crisis so that more people can respond. And people need, you know, some people just need a very simple way to get involved. And if you can go out and buy, you know, a Stella Artois chalice and it gets safe water to someone for 5 years, then that's a pretty good deal. And that promotion actually runs through the middle of April. So when people pick up a 12-pack, you know, that helps people get a year's worth of clean drinking water.
Sounds pretty cool to me.
Yeah.
Let me close with this, Gary. We had a fellow on the show a couple of months ago by the name of Louis Rosenberg. He's the CEO of Unanimous AI. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they deploy people in sort of this swarming technique, and then they use algorithms, and they actually come up with very, very good answers, better than an individual would. Well, the assignment they had was Jeff Bezos asked, what should he do with his billions of dollars? And they use Unanimous AI and swarming and algorithms, and the number one answer was make sure that everybody on Earth has access to clean drinking water, something which I'm sure you would agree with. Were you surprised by that, and do you believe that that actually will become a reality in your lifetime?
You know, I was surprised. I wouldn't have been surprised if it came out like in the top five or something like that, because it's such a wide net that they cast. But it speaks to how much people have been tuning into this issue and having local water crises around the world, whether it's, you know, in Southern California or whether it's in Sao Paulo, Brazil, or now Cape Town. And so it's much more in the consciousness of people in water quality and how we're taking care of the environment. So that doesn't surprise me that it came out in the top five, but the top one, yes. But we absolutely can solve this in our lifetime. There is no doubt. I mean, we've known how to make water safe for more than 100 years, you know, here in the United States. And as I mentioned, the capital is already there. We don't need to go out and raise $1 trillion in philanthropy to make this happen. We just need to kind of rearrange the money that's already on the table by providing these nudges to the system as opposed to trying to fundraise our way out of it.
Well, Gary White, the co-founder and CEO of water.org, thanks so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website, what listeners may find there, and how they can help support this work.
Yeah, so we do need that philanthropic capital to continue to push us forward, so people can come to water.org and make a donation and help fuel water credit. They can also, later this year, they'll be able to make a loan as little as $100 to fund a water credit investment fund going forward. So we need all hands on deck. We need people showing up with the donations as well as the investment capital.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Gary. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Denver.
I'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
St. Patrick's Day is around the corner, and listeners will have the opportunity to purchase a shamrock at over 20,000 retail locations to help save and improve the lives and families living with muscular dystrophy. And here to discuss that with us and so much more is Lynn O'Connor Voss, the president and CEO of the Muscular Dystrophy Association. Good evening, Lynn, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Well, thank you, Denver. It's a pleasure being here.
Let me begin by asking you, what is muscular dystrophy, and what do we know about this disease?
So that's a great question. Many people don't know what muscular dystrophy is, and it's an umbrella phrase. And the Muscular Dystrophy Association represents over 43 diseases that are under that umbrella. And essentially, we are an association focused on muscle. We're the world's leading expert on muscle. And the diseases that are under our umbrella include Duchenne, spinal muscular atrophy, ALS, and many, many other diseases. And most of these diseases have a genetic component, which is why today it's really very exciting to be in the muscular dystrophy business and association, because we're finally identifying the genes and the therapies that will actually change these people's lives.
How many people are affected by these diseases?
That is a really hard question to answer, and I haven't gotten a straight answer on that. But it is a rare disease. I mean, some of these are super rare diseases, and some of them are more commonly known. I think most people understand what ALS is now after the Ice Bucket Challenge, so we've heard much more about it. But that, in fact, is a super rare disease as well. So, quite frankly, Jerry Lewis put the Muscular Dystrophy Association on the map.
Sure did.
He brought children on television so more people saw the ravages of these diseases. You know, many people don't know people with these conditions because it is a rare condition. But when you look at the totality of the diseases like we do as an umbrella organization, we can impact many, many thousands of people because we are focused on the research broadly, not just specifically in one disease versus another.
And are these diseases more common among boys and girls?
Duchenne, yes. In fact, much more common among boys. But some of the other diseases are equal in their representation.
Now, MDA has three major areas of focus: research, caring for kids and adults, and empowering families. So let us briefly run through each of those, starting with research. You have taken a big picture perspective across these neuromuscular diseases, as you just said. What are some of the more promising and hopeful areas of research that you're currently engaged?
So we refer to our strategy as the four C's: cure, care, champion, and community. So let me just start with cure. We have over the years invested over $1 billion in neuromuscular research. We are the largest funder of research in ALS at $363 million. And we offer grants annually to top researchers in the country and globally. And in addition to that, we also have representatives at 150 care centers in the United States. So that's our care piece. And the fact that we are not just hosting clinics, but managing clinics and running community programs distinguishes us as an organization. So many organizations focus on research alone. The combination of research and care is really what makes our organization that much stronger. Champion is our advocacy effort, and community really relates to the absolutely amazing set of sponsors that we have locally throughout the country. The top sponsor being the firefighters, who've been working with us for over 50 years, filling the boot. Harley-Davidson, and you mentioned Shamrock, so a number of significant grocers around the country, as well as Citgo, are actively working to promote the need for cures and better care for our patients. And what we're talking about right now, which is kind of interesting, is if people work with the MDA, they're really joining kind of a movement in motion. Because think of the thousands of people that are actually working on our behalf, starting with the firefighters at 500,000 people. So there are many, many, many community events and many individuals and many volunteers who work with us on a regular basis. And the last part of community, which I didn't mention, which is very important, and that is camp. So the MDA supports 4,000 kids every year going to camp. And when our children go to camp, it's a very unique experience because they need one-on-one. So with every camper, there's a volunteer. And so I can't emphasize enough how important the volunteers have been to the MDA and to the families in every community. We probably have one of the largest army of volunteers of any organization who are actively working directly with our kids.
And you're also very mindful of the family, that a disease like this just impact an individual, but really the entire family. What kind of services and support do you provide for them?
So starting with the care centers, we manage and direct clinics. We are this year revamping our whole care center strategy in that we are developing very specific educational modules for families depending on where they are in their disease journey. We have also developed a registry that will be expanded, and in fact, that's what we're doing today with IQVIA, which is an outstanding clinical research group. And essentially, we are creating a platform at every care center for the providers to collect data and to share best practices and to deliver better services for the people with those conditions. So our family care specialists live at the care center. They directly communicate with families. And this year, in order to get smarter about what families need, we just sponsored a very extensive research with our families. We have over 3,000 families who responded to our survey, and we will be delivering very new landmark data in March about the pain points of living with these diseases. And we intend to use that data to actually populate our resource center, which now gets 25,000 calls a year. But essentially, with the resource center and making that more of a platform, we will be able to service every family in the United States. So the care centers can take you to a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is with these diseases, many people are not even in the healthcare system. They haven't had any treatments. And I can't emphasize that enough. I mean, the reason why it's been so exciting for me to join this organization, for the first time ever, there are therapies on the market that will either make incremental improvements or actually come close to curing diseases like SMA. Spinraza was a very exciting drug developed last year, introduced by Biogen.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little complicated in the way that it has to be delivered, which is intrathecal. That's a spinal injection.
Right.
But this drug, if you see the results and you talk to some of the kids and families who've had experienced Spinraza, it's close to miraculous.
That's all the headlines I've seen about it. Miracle drug.
Yes, you are.
So,
and there's others coming down the pike.
That's very exciting. You are a big believer in the role of technology and the role that it plays in healthcare. How do you see it impacting MDA's work and how this can help MDA families?
So digital health is obviously a passion of mine and something that's very relevant today in terms of impacting disease, whether it's diabetes or cancer. Interestingly enough, in neuromuscular disease, there hasn't been as many technological developments. And so we are hosting a big clinical conference in March. And for the first time, we're actually going to have a salon on technology and a keynote speaker on digital health and the role of technology. And I think you're going to see many more developments there. In ALS, there have been some people that have developed some technology to preserve people's voice when they lose their voice so they can use that. There certainly are some apps for ALS as well as for some of our neuromuscular diseases. But I think you're going to see many more companies jumping in here. Google, you know, and others to figure out how we actually mobilize artificial intelligence as well as technology to improve the care of some of these patients.
Very exciting. I mentioned in the opening the MDA Shamrocks program. Tell us a little bit more about that and how it works and how people can participate.
So, St. Patrick's Day is around the corner.
Yes, it is.
And some stores have already started. But essentially, this is a fantastic retail-based program. And we're going to continue to innovate this program. And essentially, we have Citgo and many, many grocers, Kroger's, Price Chopper, et cetera, that are asking people at point of purchase to support our cause and purchase a shamrock and post it. And so you're going to see that, again, can't help myself given my background is marketing and communication. We'll be expanding and evolving that program, just like we are expanding and evolving the Fill the Boot program, adding technology to that program, adding technology again and some social media and advertising to Shamrock. So stay tuned. You're going to see some more advertising in that space. And we encourage everybody to get out there and help our kids.
Yeah, well, the Shamrock program has raised $315 million over the past 36 years. Tell us a little bit more about Fill the Boot, because some listeners may not be familiar with that effort.
So in every firehouse and station around the country, you will see firemen out, firefighters outside with sometimes with our kids, sometimes with our families, sometimes with volunteers who go out and request people to fill the boot. They're out in traffic. When they're asking you to fill the boot, you're filling the boot for MDA. And they have been with us for, I think, close to 60 years. And the IAFF and the firefighters are actually celebrating their 100-year anniversary next Tuesday, I believe. We will be backing them and supporting them and celebrating their commitment to us. And so Fill the Boot is grassroots. You know, every community does it. It's just amazing. And also just a shout out to the firefighters. They're also instrumental in our camp program.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about the Shamrock program and you think about the Fill the Boot program, the primary focus has been to develop and expand our camp program and our community programs. And that's why people are really coming out to Fill the Boot. Where we are going with our fundraising, I would say we're expanding again and moving in an area where initially and back in the days with Jerry Lewis, we could offer camps, we could offer community events, we could offer services, we could offer wheelchairs. And now we need to really support some of these massive efforts on the mission side, because we are going to be moving into a situation where there'll be many more major therapies on the market. So all of our fundraisers, and there's an army of them out there, are really actively supporting us to offer recreational programs, expand the quality of life offerings that the MDA can provide for families, and in addition to that, support our registry, support our research, and support our care strategy.
Mm-hmm. And one of the more exciting ones, and one that I know you're thrilled about, is Live Unlimited campaign. Tell us about that.
So that's a fantastic inspirational line.
Sure is.
And it really goes with what is, again, amazing about the MDA, one of the reasons why I joined. You know, in the older days, many of these kids didn't live very long. Now you have people living into their 30s and beyond. Why? Because we've improved the care. We've improved the multidisciplinary care. We know how important it is to preserve pulmonary function, lung function, cardiac function. And so this idea of Live Unlimited is really a call out and a recognition that the children with these diseases are living longer, and we should go for it.
Mm-hmm.
We should push the limits. And so we are, when the organization announced that new line and program a few years ago, it's been amazing the number of people who've kind of come out and done extraordinary things, do-it-yourself fundraising, climbing Mount Kilimanjaro because their dad died of ALS, and raising $100,000. And so it's a really great line. It really speaks to people. It also kind of circles back to the fact that we are the world's leading expert on muscle.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about Live Unlimited, it really calls out to the athletes. And so many, many athletes, whether it's triathlons or marathons or climbing mountains, are using that as a great opportunity to do-it-yourself fundraising, GoFundMes, and bring money back to MDA, which is fantastic.
It sure is. And so many of these young people also believe they are really living their lives to the fullest, and that is fantastic to see. So, Lynn, you step into a work culture of a new organization, as you did with MDA, and I'm sure you find much of it to be very good and some other things that you'd like to make a little bit better. Tell us about the corporate culture of MDA, where you would like to see it improve, and how does a new CEO go about making those changes?
Okay. I'm in the hot seat now. Again, relatively new to the space of nonprofit, actually leading a nonprofit. However, I've spent most of my life working in nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a founding board member of the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation, also a founding board member of the Jed Foundation, and our foundation, I'm currently working with them now. Our mission is to improve the emotional health of college students and prevent suicide. What I'm finding in a large organization like the MDA, and I've done my homework, I certainly have a new network of great CEOs to speak with, because everyone in the nonprofit organization are totally open to sharing what they've learned and how they can improve their organization. Our organization is, our benefit is, we're very large,
mm-hmm.
but we're not a federation. So if I can use some business language here, you know, we have a single P&L. We don't have competing factions out there. We do have the need, however, to kind of galvanize the organization to work as one. And so having joined recently, that's really our key strategy, is to say, okay, what is, again, the mission? How do we communicate that in a very specific way on a regular basis to everyone out there? And how do we galvanize individuals to believe that we're working as one organization? And, you know, again, my view a few months into the picture is it's really about leadership, and it's really about better management. And I think many organizations just kept getting larger and really have more. There's too much latitude out in the field. We're doing a lot of fantastic things for families, but we need to do fewer things really well.
Mm-hmm.
So our strategy is going to be that. You asked earlier, like, what are we doing in the community? We're going to probably have 3 or 4 signature events that we put on every, you know, month or, you know, several times a year. But they'll be done extremely well, and there'll be a standardization. What we're doing at the Care Center, which I'm really excited about, is our team is developing standard protocols for families so that they will get the right information at the right time and what they need to actually manage their disease. And so it's probably more of a centralized approach to some of the communication and some of the tools, and then we will disseminate that back down to the field, and an open dialogue will happen. So next week, for example, we've revamped and we've created more regional headquarters out in the field. Those regional directors are coming into Chicago, and, you know, we're having a really exciting session with them on the new model of fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
What is that corporation? What's the win-win with the corporation? I have to say that I've invited some of my friends from my for-profit world of advertising to come in and really excite people about the new way to bring sponsors in and the new way to communicate our mission. You know, I think you heard me say the mission really is changing dramatically, and many of the people in the field need to understand where we're going,
yeah.
How to communicate it, how to get people excited about it. We are offering far more than just recreational programs and camp. We're offering very big opportunities. And in D.C., you know, we're going to be between the registry that we're building, the idea that we're going to get collective impact with 150 care centers, the fact that we're going to have greater access to clinical trials, the fact that clinical trials are being developed differently without a placebo base, et cetera. These are very big messages for DC. And so you're going to hear more from the MDA also on the big stage.
Well, it makes sense. If you're going to sharpen your communications, you might as well begin with your staff.
Yes, makes it, yeah.
Let me close with
kind
this,
of the
Lynn.
Basics.
I have a friend who works for MDA, and he told me with tremendous excitement that the potential for this organization over the next 5 years is just incredible, and I suspect you probably share that sentiment. Now, if I'm somebody suffering from muscular dystrophy, or if I'm one of those families, what are the possibilities that exist 5 years from now?
So the possibilities for any new family, particularly any family who may have SMA in their family, one of the things that we're doing is we are backing newborn screening. So there will be a time in the next year or two where every baby will be screened for SMA, Duchenne, and some of our conditions. If we find them that early, and you get a drug like Spinraza or perhaps some of the new gene therapies that are coming to market, you will, in fact, cure that disease.
Hmm.
Those children will start building muscle. So the earlier you treat, the less muscle loss. So that's just dramatic and unbelievable.
Sure is.
Right? Those people who are living with these diseases, the focus is going to be on improving care. So when we talked about benchmarking care and looking at multidisciplinary care and maybe adding technology to the mix and some of these incremental therapies, for example, kids with Duchenne, unfortunately, they have to use steroids from a very early age. A lot of the therapies that people are looking at right now is trying to figure out how we can displace that, not use steroids, because steroids actually limit development, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So you have many different ways that the research community and the care community are going in and trying to intervene to make this a better experience. In addition to that, you know, there are some miraculous stories of kids out there. We have a guy who I love who's in our resource center. Hugo is one of the people living with our diseases. He's in his late 20s. He's just about to get Spinraza. He has SMA. And he is an amazing human being.
Hmm.
And so we need to tell those stories more broadly, the people that are living with these conditions. And I would also say I'm pretty amazed at this moment, special needs is more recognized out there. You just recently saw Gerber is going to have the Down syndrome baby.
Right.
Many, many people care and want to do more for our families. And, you know, we're going to attract more people to our mission.
Exciting times for MDA. Well, Lynn O'Connor Voss, the president and CEO of the Muscular Dystrophy Association, thanks so much for being here this evening. Tell us about the kind of information someone will find on your website and how people can become involved in supporting your work.
So go to our website and you will hear more about camps. You'll hear how to sign up to be a volunteer. Certainly, you'll be able to find the local place to buy a shamrock and support us. And I would say, clearly, keep your eyes open for the firefighters and fill the boot. And watch this year. You're going to hear more from us, more publications, more announcements, more news about some of the therapies that are coming out. And we would, you know, love for you to support us in any way you can, starting with volunteer. So you'll know there are people who are working for MDA in many, many markets, most of the major markets, and our care centers are in 150 locations. And so you can probably find MDA either at the fire station or in the news or go to our website.
Okay? Just around the corner. Well, we'll stay tuned. Thanks, Lynn. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Johnny, that's better than most. That is better than most. Better than most!
Better Than Most is a regular feature of The Business of Giving, examining the best places to work among social businesses and nonprofit organizations.
And for this evening's Better Than Most, you'll be visiting one of the more spectacular places that we have been. It is the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. We'll begin with the CEO of the Kennedy Center, Deborah Rutter, and then hear from other members of the Kennedy Center staff.
My goal has been for us to be a much more horizontal organization where we work collaboratively across all of the art forms and across all of our areas of expertise. We do so with a sense of pride and responsibility and ultimately a commitment to our artists and our audiences. Respect is probably the most important value that we hold for one another, and I think that trickles down from JFK himself. And literally, for those of you who have never been to the Kennedy Center, there is enormous bust that sits watching over all of us in the grand foyer at the Kennedy Center. And so a day doesn't pass where we don't all experience JFK watching over us.
Deborah showed up, and one of the first things she said is, "What in the world? Why in the world are you guys all segmented like this? We're not going to have this." So she put us all in one large department, which is really funny because I'm an old timer. I've been here about 23 years. And for those of us who have been here that length of time, we know that that's how we used to operate. But then over time, things became more segmented and more segmented. And so we worked in these isolated areas. Well, she came and said, "Oh my gosh, this is crazy. Let's put you all back together." So now we have a newly reconstituted programming department, which has allowed all of the programmers to do a blended multidisciplinary approach to the programming that we present at the Kennedy Center, which has been so terrific. And it really speaks to what we can offer uniquely as the Kennedy Center.
In the past, I would say that education was absolutely siloed and seen as something that primarily focuses on kindergarten through grade 12. What do we do in schools? How do we support that type of programming? But education has taken on a brand new meaning in the last few years, particularly looking at a lifetime of learning, being much more thoughtful about what that means. What are the opportunities to connect to the art, to be able to make the education part and art education part of a meaningful lifetime.
You get to hear these fabulous stories of how we're going to, you know, how people want to expand the arts in the community and what their moonshots are and how they're going to strive to do better. And it's just kind of one of those things. It's never a dull moment. You're always getting to experience something new and interact with the community and see how they want the Kennedy Center to play a role not only in their community, but also in the nation, and hopefully, you know, as we work every day in the world.
We don't just book things that are guaranteed to be sellout performances. We know that we stand for more than that, and so much so that many of us, you'll notice, actually carry around the mission, vision, and values of the Kennedy Center with our IDs. And I think that's been really interesting because I think a lot of organizations go through these long processes of figuring out what those values are, and then they kind of shove them aside, never to look at them again. But we have that daily reminder on our ID badges. We have staff meetings, and we have employee recognition. And when we're calling out an employee who has done something well, we're talking about what value of the Kennedy Center that employee is exemplifying.
We are all a part of pods, which are small groups that have education and marketing and a public relations presence, as well as production and programming and development. And together we get the ideas flowing, and we're able to think critically about what we're trying to do when engaging the public and how to get more people involved with the Kennedy Center.
Because usually facilities management is behind the scene. You know, you're in the dungeons. You make sure everything is running and you are not seen. So I struggled with that for a while, and it was not until the Kennedy Center leadership started placing emphasis on guest experience and client satisfaction that I was able to make the connection between the mission and the clients and facilities. For example, what is experience that the patrons will go through when coming into the Kennedy Center?
Several weeks or months go by, and the show or event happens. And then after it's finished, we make a point to have what we're calling a wash-up, which is really a post-event evaluation and reflection upon what happened. And that is something that we need to do because there are so many people involved. We have a myriad of different departments, and we are so large, sometimes the bureaucracy has impeded our progress to be able to make improvement. So this new creative brief, followed by the post-event wash-up, has allowed us to look long-term, to think how, what infrastructure, what processes, what systems that we might be able to improve upon to make a long-term change among the culture of the organization.
It's been really exciting to be a part of something that allows me personally to grow as a member of the institution, to have curiosities and to be rewarded for those curiosities and to have new opportunities, and most importantly, to also be able to mentor and identify new people who may be really wonderful assets to the institution. So not only growing yourself, but having the opportunity to help be a part of someone else's growth is such a tremendous thing.
From the moment they go, they, you know, get their parking ticket and they park their car, to the moment they walk out of that car, go up that escalator and into that theater and see that performance and then walk right back out. It's having that commitment to having this unforgettable experience that you will take with you for the rest of your life.
Aside from the amazing artists we get to see and going to many performances and being backstage at photo shoots, things of that nature, you're just surrounded by some of the most brilliant art administrators in the field. And there's this type of this feeling that you get. It's not tangible, but it's an amazing feeling when you are in a room with these groups of people who are creating the work that you see on stage, but beyond that, trying to figure out how to share that art beyond the walls of the Kennedy Center. How can we get as many people to experience this art that we see on a daily basis? And it's really quite exhilarating.
One of the things that I am most proud of by working here is we offer a free performance daily on the Millennium Stage. So this is every day at 6 p.m. And if you're not physically able to be in the building, you can actually watch this through our live stream on Facebook and YouTube. So it's a wonderful opportunity for those who may not be able to experience the arts within our building to be able to view in and see all the different sorts of genres that we have to present.
One of the benefits of working at the Kennedy Center is that you are allowed the opportunity to witness and participate on multiple special events and signature events like honors and Mark Twain Prize and so on. And what I like about it is that even though I'm part of that event, I'm the facilities guy in disguise. But then I become the ambassador to the president of the Kennedy Center, because the message from the president of the Kennedy Center is make sure every person, every patron, every visitor feels welcome.
When the opportunity to come back to the Kennedy Center came up again, I said, I need to take another look. Something is different. And it turns out that things have changed quite a bit here. I think many of my colleagues have touched upon aspects of institutional change. And so what I will say is that there is a warmth here that is, I think, new and very representative of the kind of cultural change that has started at the top with Deborah's leadership, absolutely. There was always an entrepreneurial spirit at the Kennedy Center. We've always put on a tremendous number of performances, but now there is a humanity to our day-to-day that I know a lot of us find very energetic.
I want to extend my thanks to all those who participated in this piece. Michelle Pendoli, Kevin Struthers, Jeanette McCune, John Guastello, Lauren Holland, Derek Johnson, and Carlos Elias. To hear this again, read the transcript, or see pictures of the participants and the Kennedy Center itself, come to denver-frederick.com. And we'll have a link there to my interview with Deborah Rutter, the Chief Executive Officer of the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. And that is this week's show. Next Sunday, I'll be joined by Kathleen Kelly Janis, the author of a wonderful new book entitled Social Startup Success, How the Best Nonprofits Launch, Scale Up, and Make a Difference. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and I hope you'll return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.